I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, part of the New Books Network. You'd think it would go without saying that women's rights are human rights. But actually, it was only a couple of decades ago that feminist activists had to work hard to convince the mainstream human rights community that this was the case. Niamh Riley has documented this struggle in her book, Women's Human Rights, which came out with Polity Press in 2009. And she's done much more. She's given us a framework for understanding a movement that rests on notions of women's shared concerns across the globe, but which also recognizes their differences. She's given us a terrific overview of how the movement for women's human rights has tackled issues like the situation of women during armed conflict, violence against women in the so-called private sphere, reproductive rights, and the impact of economic development on women. And she tackles the thorny intersection of women's rights and multiculturalism. I learned a lot from reading Riley's book, and I think you'll enjoy our interview. Hello, Niamh.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. We have today Niamh Riley, author of Women's Human Rights with Polity Press from 2009, and I'm very happy to have her on the show. Let me start out just by asking you, Niamh, a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little about your background, how you got into this line of work.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Ireland. I was born and raised in the Dublin area in Ireland. And left for the United States in 1984 to, and after a short period, then pursued graduate studies in economics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and then on to Rutgers, initially studying economics, international political economy, but switched over to political theory to study feminist political theory at Rutgers with a wonderful department there with some with Sue Carroll and Linda Zerilli. And at that time, as a graduate student, I met Charlotte Bunch, who had just had come to Rutgers rather recently as the Lower New Jersey chair, and went on then to establish in the very early days a project on global women's leadership. And I began to work with Charlotte at that point as a part-time assistant as a graduate student. And over those years, then, from a very small little project, it grew the Center for Women's Global Leadership. So while I was working towards my PhD studies and, you know, in feminist theory, I was also working in what turned out to be an extremely exciting project, which was really bringing a global perspective to a very well-established women's studies and women's research sort of community within Rutgers. So that's how I became drawn into the women's rights as human rights theme, which became a focal theme for the establishment of the Center for Women's Global Leadership in the early 1990s.
Tell us a little bit about the Center for Women's Global Leadership, because that is such an important institution.
Yeah, well, at the time it was very small. It was a handful. It was Charlotte Bunch and really a handful of graduate students at the very beginning, and as I said, the idea was to bring a global perspective to women's studies. Now, Charlotte Bunch had a long sort of history working in the international women's movement through the UN Decade for Women, 1975 to 1985, and so had many relationships and contacts with women's networks and organizations internationally. And we always knew that this was going to be a part of what the new center would do. And there wasn't quite a name for the center at the time. It was a very long name. I can't remember it now. It was something like the Center for Global Issues and Women's Leadership. And there was a lot of discussion about what the name of the center should be. But also at that time in the early 90s, with the end of the Cold War, with the end of apartheid in South Africa and so on, it was a very exciting moment of new possibilities as to what kind of framework and discourse might inform global politics in a post-Cold War world. And there was a sort of a mini renaissance around human rights that began to emerge. So human rights, there was talk of a world conference on human rights. The last one had been 25 years ago in Tehran. There hadn't been a world conference on human rights throughout, most of the Cold War period, mainly because of the kind of disagreements and the political impasse around what human rights were, and this very classic division between focusing on civil and political rights in the so-called West and developed world, and then the focus on economic and cultural rights that was really pushed by the then communist bloc countries. So there was a standoff in terms of what human rights were about. And the end of the Cold War created the conditions where new conversations were happening about human rights. And at the same time, the decade on women, the UN decade for women, had created conditions of really a proliferation of women's organizations and networks internationally that were very oriented towards the global stage. And the issue of violence against women had begun to emerge through that as a clear common issue, even though it affected different women differently in different parts of the world. It was one of the issues that kept recurring. So whether you were talking about the refuge movement in North America, or you were dealing with female infanticide in Asia, or dowry-related death in Africa, or honor killing in Brazil, it seemed that the common theme was that there was a profound issue around different forms of gender-based violence against women that women could have common cause in. And it also seemed that this framework of human rights, well, why were women's rights not central to human rights? At that time, the phrase women's human rights didn't exist in the lexicon. People didn't talk about women's human rights. They talked about women's rights, which meant something very narrow and specific, usually within kind of Western developed countries, and human rights, which meant something very serious and with great gravitas and of international importance. But that concept at that time didn't embrace women's rights. So various organizations and groups that the Global Center was connected with began to meet and discuss, and how could we bring issues of women's human rights to the center of the mainstream human rights agenda, where they had been not been dealt with and had been excluded to date. So this whole focus then became really the centerpiece around which the Center for Women's Global Leadership emerged and developed all of its programming. The idea of saying, well, let's bring women's human rights issues, and particularly the issue of violence against women, to this international human rights conference. So and it was very much a multi-level campaign, which obviously I cover in the book at length. But the idea was that there would be broad-based ways that could allow women's organizations, groups and activists to engage with the campaign on a community and grassroots level, as well as other mechanisms such as popular tribunals, as well as ways of lobbying for specific language change at the highest levels within the UN. So the Global Campaign for Women's Human Rights was all about linking women's groups, networks, advocates across regions, across sectors, across concerns. But there's no doubt that the issue of violence against women was a rallying and, a kind of a unifying theme in the sense that there was common cause. And then the idea was to get these issues on the human rights agenda. And there was a massive petition campaign. There were various popular tribunals and so on. But that work then really became the foundation for the Center for Women's Global Leadership's continuing engagement from there on in the integration of gender and feminist perspectives in across all sorts of UN policy areas. The kind of, it was the methodology and the way that the center worked was very significant. But from my perspective, it was hugely influential in terms of my understanding of what the feminist project was about. It was a kind of a feminist praxis that that was very self-consciously paid attention to inclusivity across all kinds of divides and boundaries, regional, international for sure, but also across ethnicity, class, sexual orientation, ability, and so on, disability, and so on. That there was a very active praxis around inclusivity in the meetings, in the events, in the training programs, in the leadership institutes, all of which fed in to very concrete campaigning work. In the years that I was there, that concrete campaigning work spanned the 1993 World Conference on Human Rights, but then went on. You may be familiar with the whole series of UN conferences that took place in the 1990s, which was part of this renaissance in human rights thinking, this idea of how now are we going to approach heading into the new millennium and so on, what are going to be the frameworks for approaching global policy issues. So you had the predating the World Conference on Human Rights in 1993 had been the Rio Summit on the environment. You then had the 1993 Conference on Human Rights. That was quickly followed by the World Summit on Social Development, the International Conference on Population and Development. Habitat was another conference that took place in 2005. On to the Durban Conference Against Racism and Forms of Intolerance and Xenophobia. So there was a whole series of, really the 1990s was a decade of major UN conferences that were really about reinventing and rethinking how we view the world, how we view social justice, how we view human rights, how we deal with emerging crises, whether it's around conflict, environmental destruction. But the one of the core themes from the kind of feminist perspective was putting a spotlight on different forms of gender-based violence and violence against women and how they cut across all of these issues, but then more broadly bringing issues of women's empowerment and women's human rights across a whole variety of agendas where they had been absent. So I think that those years were the Center for Women's Global Leadership, along with a lot of other kind of key networks and groups that had worked with internationally, did play, you know, an important role in shaping agendas and in creating opportunities and spaces for many other women's organizations and groups to enter into formative debates. The ICC was another example, the International Criminal Court process, which came, which a lot of the groups and organizations that had been involved in the longer global campaign for women's human rights also became involved in looking for gender-sensitive responses within the International Criminal Court in the wake of all these horrendous conflicts and the exposés in terms of the use of sexual violence and conflict and so on in your former Yugoslavia and then later in Rwanda. So there was an awful lot of synergy, I suppose, and an awful lot of new energy and new momentum around integrating very comprehensively, taking seriously what it meant to really insert notions of kind of profound gender equality and women's human rights into a whole range of agendas that were emerging throughout that time.
Well, you've already taken us into some of the really central themes of the book. We get this wonderful sense of the 1990s as this very lively, dynamic historical moment, right, with sort of one conference after another and people organizing really globally. You use the term cosmopolitan feminism.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk about that a little, because it seems to tie in a little bit with this effort of coalition building of the global scope of this movement.
Yeah.
What's cosmopolitan feminism?
This book grows out of two main, I suppose, influences. One is the practical work that I was engaged in throughout the 1990s in terms of advancing women's rights as human rights, and also my doctoral research in feminist theory, which was really trying to answer some of the very well-grounded critiques of feminism as a project in terms of its failures to deal with the kind of the diversity of women, and also the growing influence from the 1990s onward of the kind of postmodern epistemological critique, really challenging the grand narratives of human rights, of equality and freedom and so on, and as the possible basis for a transformative movements that appeared to require commonality of experience and commonality of identity among women. So it was very clear to me that this, what I was seeing in terms of movements for human rights, did not actually require this commonality of experience and identity. In fact, it worked with the diversity and the difference, and not just you know, necessarily. I mean, obviously, there's there is a great deal of celebration and respect across difference, but also difference and difference in terms of priorities and difference in terms of experience. Also, comes with that comes conflict and tension. So I was, you know, very much conscious that. From my perspective, what I was seeing with the women's rights as human rights movement was a particular way of addressing and dealing with all of these differences and tensions and conflicts, as well as the, if you like, the more positive synergies that go with people working across different perspectives and different locations. And that I wanted a way to theorize how you could work with, or how what I saw in practice was women's groups, organizations working with and around all of the differences in their positive form and in their kind of more challenging and perhaps conflictual forms, and how that was a combination that was achieved by reference to this overarching framework of women's rights as human rights. So that it allowed for quite a lot of diversity, difference of opinion, difference of prioritization in terms of issues and so on. But it still also facilitated a kind of solidarity towards transforming oppressive structural forces that may take different forms and be experienced differently by different women. But nonetheless, there was a certain commonality. It's what Chandra Mohanty, I think borrowing from Dorothy Smith, calls common differences. That there are, forces and structures that we may call patriarchal or capitalist or racist, and that women, different women experiencing them differently, and they experience them through a lens of cumulative disadvantage or cumulative advantage, depending on where they are located within the global economy and within various kinds of power structures. But there is nonetheless, it's nonetheless possible to identify a common moment on which solidarity can be built. And I suppose what I was interested in was capturing and thematizing and theorizing what those common moments were, and how the assertion or the insistence that there are global norms and that women are entitled to claim human rights can be a bridge across these differences in a way that amplifies the common purpose. Now, this is without making any claims of sameness or commonness of experience. So, cosmopolitan, I use the phrase cosmopolitan feminism to capture this notion of the centrality of the claim that women's rights are human rights, which is a socially constructed notion. You can't, you'll never win the argument or the debate about the foundations of human rights. It is by convention we agree that there are human rights, and that's the point of departure in political projects. And but there is no sort of single way of a priori or preemptively defining what the content of those rights are. The content of those rights can only really be defined in context by the claimants of those rights through transformative political projects and struggles. But that's very different from, it's not the same thing as suggesting a kind of a radical relativism, because those differences are worked out always in the context of asserting that there are universal human rights to be claimed.
I wonder if you could give us an example, either from the book or from your own experience, of how this kind of tension works between, on the one hand, different experiences depending on positioning, as you say, in the global economy and in many other ways, and at the same time, a common language. How does that play itself out in the women's human rights movement?
Well, I think there are tremendous pluses and minuses around the way in which the issue of violence against women has really surfaced as a very unifying issue. There are also problems with that, but I think that the way in which the issue of violence against women plays out is a very good illustration of how that diversity and commonality works, and how the kind of the claim of the global claim, or the claim of the right to be free from violence, allows very different women from very different perspectives to specify the content of that claim that in ways that are context specific. So as I said earlier on, in the kind of northern so-called developed countries, the focus was on refuge provision, and still is, and service provision for women who experience domestic abuse, and that still continues to be quite a struggle, you know, particularly in the kind of current economic recession, borderline depression, and the, you know, the reduction of your public expenditure and so on in providing supports and services and in vindicating the right to be free from violence in the home. So we see that has been a major issue, continues to be a major issue. But you also then have violence against women taking other kinds of forms. And so the issue of honor killing, or the issue of or issues around, you know, acid burning or dispossession or dowry related violence, that these would be very context specific issues that women's groups on the ground would bring to light and would challenge, using a human rights framework to make that challenge, but the content being articulated in a way that is aware of and sensitive to the cultural and the context specificities in which the claim is being made, so that there's no, if you like, one size fits all. I mean, one of the flash point issues that I think it's very much been resolved more or less within international women's movements, but one of the kind of sources of conflict had been the issue of female genital cutting, where in the earlier part of the UN decade for women, Western based women's advocates and organizations felt particularly strongly about female genital cutting, female genital mutilation. And this created quite a bit of tension between women's organizations and groups from the global north and those from the global south, who found themselves in a position of being defensive about the practice. Because I'm talking about the early part of the UN Decade for Women, where there was a feeling that this was a mode of neo-imperialism. This was part of what Gayatri Spivak would say, a kind of a syndrome of saving brown women from brown men, or white women saving brown women from brown men, and very much fraught with complicated neo-imperialist and post-colonial power relations, and a failure to understand that really, if you're going to have a kind of a non-oppressive, transformative women's human rights movement, the way in which issues are challenged, who challenges, who speaks for, who articulates the claim, has to come from within the contexts where the rights are being violated. Now, things are that since then, indigenous movements in places where female genital cutting and mutilation are practiced have developed, and there's very little equivocation about the practice, but that it is a violation of women's bodily integrity and girls' bodily integrity and rights and so on. But at that time, you had a very direct clash. And I think that when I talk about cosmopolitan feminism, I'm talking about a feminism that embraces women's rights as human rights, but in a way that cannot be separated from an understanding of how one does human rights, of how you do human rights, and what kind of political practices are engaged in the pursuit of those human rights. So external imposition, top-down diktats, cultural insensitivity, and that goes across in all directions. I mean, cultural sensitivity in all directions does not give you a non-oppressive and an emancipatory form of human rights. It gives you a problematic imposition of human rights. So I suppose one of the messages of the book is that the way we do human rights, the human rights practice and the politics of our practice around human rights is as important as the naming of the issues and the content. So it's to get away from that tendency of naming all the things that are naming a priori what the human rights issues are. They can only actually be named and prioritized in context if what we care about is non-oppressive human rights practice.
And of course, it sounds like almost a contradiction in terms. How would you come up with an oppressive human rights practice? But I think the example you just gave helps us out with that, the notion of in a sense, Western outsiders, you know, coming in with a very strong critique could obviously feel very oppressive for people living within communities where they're understanding practices, you know, a female genital cutting, for example, within a larger context and within very textured relationships. You said something very interesting earlier on about human rights, in a sense, existing because being something socially constructed, something that we have come up with, and I love your assertion that we will never come up with an answer to the question of the origins of human rights, but they exist because we assert them, and this business of making claims from within communities and within societies and cultures, I think is such an interesting and important one. And of course, one of the very important insights that came from women making claims has to do with the so-called public-private split, which has been so important in the history of human rights, but also of liberalism. And I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about that public-private divide and how that's played itself out in the history of women's human rights.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the big challenges when in the early 90s, women's groups began to ask, well, why, you know, given that violence against women and domestic violence in particular, and you know, violence in the home is such a huge issue for so many women worldwide and such a serious issue and a life-threatening issue, why is it that it's not seen as a human rights issue? And this required then unpicking some of the kind of core concepts and the kind of the logic, the discursive logic of human rights, and how human rights have been institutionalized and practiced. And of course, the liberal public-private divide is very much at the core of how human rights have been institutionalized under the influence of, you know, the hegemonic Western influences in particular. So if you take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights per se, it covers the whole gambit of human rights. It doesn't necessarily, talk about the public sphere. It doesn't necessarily single out states as violators of human rights. But yet, reflecting the hegemony and the dominance of liberal Western states, human rights came to be institutionalized as if violations by state actors in the public sphere were the most important thing about what human rights are about. In other words, the fear of the arbitrary use of state power came to define what human rights are about. So if we think about Amnesty International, it's very much about, you know, arbitrary detention, prisoners of conscience, people denied freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of association. All of these associational civil rights that are hugely important, particularly in terms of kind of collective organization, in terms of human freedom in this public sphere sense. But somehow they came to define the whole of what human rights were about and leave intact the private sphere. And the cultural sphere as, if you like, a privatized sphere within human rights, where it became where it was much more difficult to name things that are happening in the private sphere as violations of human rights, because they've come to be understood from the Universal Declaration in 1948 through the kind of Cold War period as violations by state actors of particular kinds of civil and political rights. So when you had a situation where women's organizations wanted violence against women and domestic violence to be understood as a human rights issue, this huge barrier had to be overcome, which is that anything that happens in the private sphere can't be understood as a human rights violation, because human rights violations have come to be understood as things that states do to citizens in this public sphere sense of the word, right? So that meant immediately unpicking the way in which the public-private divide played out in human rights discourse and in the understanding of what human rights violations were. Also, because human rights is an international framework, it's mapped on to international relations, which are structured fundamentally around, you know, this idea of autonomous sovereign states, that are territorial and self-determining, and therefore any kind of mode of international law always has this kind of constraint that it consists only of things that states agree to. So the human rights system is, by definition, a voluntary arrangement, and the fundamental, if you like, legal unit is the state. But of course, feminists have always critiqued this notion of the homogeneous, autonomous state actor. It's critics of kind of mainstream international relations critique this is fundamental to the critique to critical international relations. So you have you end up with a very state-centric notion of what human rights are about. And therefore, if it is a state that signs up to human rights, then it is a state. It is a state's actions that become the focus of human rights. And this had to be problematized by feminists in order to see that actions by non-state actors are also violations of human rights, just because they're perpetrated by, in this case, a family member, a spouse, a private actor, right? So part of what had to happen was to put pressure on this to really expand the focus from looking at bad things that states do to things that states fail to do to protect people from human rights abuses by third parties. So you get this idea of yes, states must protect human rights. They must sign up to agree, but they must also promote human rights by ensuring that third parties, not only states, don't violate human rights. And they must fulfill their commitments, which is really about the resource issue, which is the other part of the public-private divide. So you have the public-private divide, which is the classic liberal public-private divide, which has operated within the human rights paradigm in similar ways as it has done at if you like, sub-state level, to conceal abuses that happen in the private sphere. So we had kind of parallel logic in terms of defining, say, for example, violence against women as a crime, which was what a lot of the kind of women's movements in the Europe, North America have worked on in the last number of decades from second wave feminism. So you have a similar sort of parallel problematic at the international level of making visible what happens in private spheres by private actors as violations of human rights in the first instance. And huge progress has been made in naming what private actors do as violations of human rights. The other aspect of the public-private is this wider battle with the rise of neoliberal logic, which is really about shrinking the role of the state safeguarding the welfare and the well-being of the people in its jurisdiction. So the steady pressure to shrink the state, deregulate, minimize public expenditure, and so on, is a huge obstacle to advancing social and economic rights, because the human rights system is a state-centered system in the sense that it basically puts the onus on states to protect, promote, and fulfill human rights. But if at the same time you have huge pressures to minimize and constrain and curtail state action, by definition you're minimizing the potential for states to be more proactively involved in safeguarding the range of social and economic rights that affect women hugely. So we see with this long trajectory towards deregulation, privatization, and so on, the well-documented shift in the burden of care back to women, the privatization of the burden of care, which falls on women. So whether that's care for our children, for dependents, people with disabilities, elderly, and so on. In most societies all around the world, women continue to carry the disproportionate burden of care for those in need, for those who are most vulnerable in society. And when you have this drive towards privatization, essentially it's a systematic drive of increasing that burden, privatizing that burden onto women and increasing that burden on women as states pull out and play an ever decreasing role and take ever less responsibility for ensuring these very, very basic needs, whether it's children's special needs and special learning needs, or care for people with disabilities, or and so on and so forth. That when you have a trend towards less state involvement as part of a wider trend towards the privatization, deregulation, and the kind of reducing the influence of the state, you fundamentally are at odds with the promise of human rights across the social and the economic side of the spectrum of human rights. And the radical or the transformative potential of human rights lies in a kind of a strong commitment to the indivisibility of human rights and to the interrelation of all human rights, that it's not really possible to separate out some rights and say these are the most important rights and the rest are less important, as has happened, as was the case throughout the kind of second half of the 20th century, where civil and political rights in a narrow sense were accepted as the most important human rights, and everything else was optional and could follow. But this has huge gender dimensions, because the social and the economic, the right to clean water, accommodation, basic primary health, education, all of these rights are absolutely central to the lives of most women in most parts of the world. And where you have less and less support for those from states, you have a much greater burden of care on women, and an exacerbation of inequalities in the distribution of the resources and the goods and the benefits in any given society. So those are the two aspects of the public-private divide and how they play out. There's the concealing of abuses that happen in the private sphere. You get the privatization of other kinds of cultural practices that are harmful to women, as well as the concealment of abuses, into the domestic abuse and domestic violence. But you also have a public-private configuration that has really defined the last 30 years, which is about the attack on the reduction of the state and the minimization of the state and privatization in general, and privatization of healthcare and privatization of social care and all of these things, which affect women in particular in very profound ways and really erode and impede the prospects for their enjoyment of the full range of human rights.
Right. And as you note, of course, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has plenty to say about healthy living conditions,
yeah,
and workplace conditions that are not overly dangerous,
yes,
or burdensome. And these are exactly the sorts of things,
sure,
you're talking about. But of course, as you note, they don't sort of fall into that political rights category, mm-hmm, of the political prisoner. And it's useful to sort of go back and remember that this was part of the original,
absolutely,
human rights,
yeah,
package.
Yeah.
Right. This is not something new we're inventing. But of course, it does seem to take on a different life. And you talk about this in your book, in the post-Cold War era of neoliberalism and globalization and development policies as well, international development politics, which do stretch back into the era of the Cold War and often became entangled with the Cold War. I wonder if you'd like to tell us a little bit about some of these, you know, what some people might call first world, third world issues, the global north, the global south. How does this all tie into issues that we now think about with globalization?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the challenges, there is a, you know, there's a very long-standing chasm between the sort of the, in terms of the international NGO communities and advocacy communities that are focused around development and sort of economic and social justice issues in a global frame, and those who have advocated around human rights. There's this, Philip Alston talks about ships passing in the night. You know, traditionally you have development advocates are very programmatically oriented. They're very interested in you know, the deployment of resources on the ground and making an immediate difference to people's day-to-day lives. And they perceive human rights advocates often as kind of up in the air, preoccupied with kind of legal norms and battles for legal reform, that even if they are achieved, actually will make no difference to the in the day-to-day lives of your people who most need transformation. And, you know, I think that you know, this continues to be, you know, a huge issue and a huge challenge of making the links between the struggle to make real, you know, human rights commitments and human rights norms and human rights principles, and to actually address kind of, you know, the gross discrepancies in terms of access to the basics for survival and for a kind of a reasonable quality of life, which is denied the vast majority of, you know, people on the planet. You know, it is, you know, the majority, the world's majority, do not experience things like clean water and, you know, education and decent livelihoods, and are, you know, very susceptible to exploitation in all kinds of forms. So the, you know, the struggle to link the two is ongoing and is not easy. But I think that Amartya Sen work, you know, on human development, you know, tries to foreground the importance of, you know, political engagement in achieving economic justice and social justice. And this again is a way. So the capabilities approach and the human development paradigm is an example of the influence of human rights thinking migrating into development thinking. So the idea of putting the human person and their empowerment, including, you know, very, very specifically from our Amartya Sen point of view, including their rights claiming aspects of their empowerment at the center of achieving the social and the economic economic justice. So this again is about indivisibility, of fusing the political rights, which are the freedom of expression, the freedom of association, and we see it in the moment with the Arab Spring and so on, that, you know, people are, you know, very conscious of these sort of civil and political rights and their mobilization and having access to them and being able to exercise them as a key part to bringing about transformation. But the challenge is to link the exercise of those kinds of rights to also bringing about very kind of concrete shifts in allocations of resources and power, and in ways that really benefit the most vulnerable and the most disenfranchised in a society which no society has really achieved completely as yet. So there is a long history of it, even at the time when the CEDAW, which was the Women's Convention, you know, in the first post the kind of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, throughout the 50s, 60s, and all the way into the 70s, you know, a real, a very kind of stalwart team of women worked within the UN system to bring about, you know, important, the adoption of important global norms around advancing women's equality and women's rights. And at the same time, you then had, you know, throughout the 75 to 85, you then had the rise of the more, if you like, development-oriented women's networks and organizations. And at that time, they were ships passing in the night. They didn't really see the relevance the burgeoning, growing movement of women's organizations and groups that arose through the UN Decade for Women was very much focused on programmatic issues, on the inclusion of women in development, on gender and development paradigms, which understood that you needed to tackle unequal gender power relations in order to tackle, really include women in development. So things like, for example, disparities in the ownership of land and inheritance and, you know, the microcredit movement and all of that. So women's organizations that were coming up through the UN Decade on Women did not see at that point the relevance of CEDAW. So it was this idea of, well, this is just a very legalistic strategy that's really focused on, you know, making elite women equal to elite men. But what happened in the 1990s, you began to see more interrelation and more sort of cooperation between those two strands. And that led to CEDAW experiencing quite a transformation and a boost. It had very much been the poor cousin of the human rights system with very few resources. It met infrequently. It didn't have the same, tools at its disposal to put pressure on states and so on. But with the Global Campaign for Women's Human Rights, you then saw CEDAW being really strengthened. And CEDAW is a very interesting convention among conventions, among the UN Human Rights Conventions, because it very much gives equal billing to the political, the civil, the social, the economic and the cultural rights, and always has done. So the Global Campaign for Women's Human Rights was very instrumental in backing a move to strengthen and increase, you know, the number of meetings, the resources, the powers of CEDAW, in particular the adoption of the individual complaints procedure, the group complaints procedure, an inquiry procedure. All of these things are tools and mechanisms that make CEDAW a stronger treaty. And it's a treaty that tries to integrate, more so than any other treaty, the economic, I mean, CERD, which is the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, is similar. But CEDAW is probably more comprehensive in its attempts to integrate across the social, economic and cultural. But one of the main big challenges in this whole world of development and global justice economically is the fact that the human rights system, it goes back to the fact that the human rights system is state-centric, and it very much puts the burden, the onus or the responsibility for achieving rights on states. And one of the criticisms that is often made is that in a very unequal world where states are very unequal vis-a-vis each other, putting a burden on developing world states or very poor states to achieve certain rights is unfair and simply doesn't acknowledge the discrepancy in means and resources and so on. And so, you know, probably what might be surprising to some is that it's a lot of third world states that have resisted strengthening the social and economic rights because of the obligation that puts and the strain that puts on the necessity of the state in basically providing the basics in terms of health, welfare, education and so on. And this brings us then to the whole debate around the right to development. So what is the right to development? That was, a movement that came out of the New International Economic Order movement of the 1970s that really wanted to challenge global capitalism as the main engine of economic growth and prosperity and so on. And what this does is it really begs the question about, you know, if the human rights system is state-centric, who is responsible then? What is the responsibility of transnational actors or intergovernmental actors to nations that are struggling to develop? So is there an obligation? Is there something called the international community that has an obligation to observe and to encourage and to deliver on human rights beyond their own state? And legally, there is no basis for that. But politically, that argument is often made. So when you have, for example, at Durban, you often get a kind of a call from groups of formerly colonized states, for example, looking for reparation for the damage done through the period of colonization, or looking for reparation in terms of for slavery or for past egregious violations of human rights of that type, to recognize the way in which the historical conditions have fundamentally impaired and put certain countries at a disadvantage. But one of the huge limitations of the international human rights system is that it still essentially rests on state obligation. And it doesn't have the capacity at this stage of naming something called the international community, which has an obligation. So in other words, we have bilateral aid, we have, you know, development aid, but it's very much in the model of charity and, you know, kind of an optional giving of resources from the wealthy countries to the poorer countries. It's not on a rights-based footing because there isn't an entity above the state that can be obligated to assist countries in their development through, you know, within in that human rights sense at present. So that's been a big debate as well. That is ongoing, yeah.
You know, when you talk about sort of international mechanisms, one of the places where there does seem to have been some movement, and like you say, dating back from the 1990s, is in the business of sexual violence as a weapon of war. And you spoke very briefly earlier on about Rwanda and Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Court becoming a place where indeed perpetrators can be tried. And you devote some space in your book to this business of conflict and post-conflict, where we mean armed conflict, either state conflict or civil conflict, wars. And that's also been just such a very important area of growth, of recognizing that sexual violence against women or children or men in some cases as well during war is not just business as usual, but that this is a crime. And there has been movement in the international court system. I wonder if you can talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there has, you know, the International Criminal Court statute for the first time defined a whole raft of gender-based violations, you know, rape and sexual slavery and forced pregnancy and trafficking as war crimes and crimes against humanity. Up until then, they had been understood as crimes against honor. And they weren't named, they weren't singled out. And of course, crimes against honor suggest that they're problematic because they impair the value of a woman within a community or her value vis-a-vis, you know, men, rather than in and of themselves being violations. So that was, you know, hugely important in terms of norm setting. Now there are reservations and there are concerns about how much can be achieved through, by a kind of a maybe too great a focus on the prosecution of wartime sexual violence from the perspective of delivering to women what it is women need who have lived through and experienced wartime sexual violence, whether on kind of, you know, individual level or as part of kind of a kind of a systematic and the massive use of sexual violence. And I think there's no doubt that impunity for sexual violence and the recognition of sexual violence as war crime and crime against humanity, all, you know, are hugely important. But there is a danger that the achievement of this recognition and the prosecution of a handful of cases might be perceived as being the solution. And there's also evidence to suggest that there's not a whole lot of case examples where sexual violence has been prosecuted. And in the cases that there have been, It is, you know, in the case of Rwanda, it's rape as an aspect of genocide, which is fine and important, but again, not in and of itself as a crime against humanity or as a war crime. And, you know, where there's, you know, for example, in the situation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, you know, there is research that I'm aware of that's ongoing at the moment with women who are survivors of wartime sexual violence. There is a lot of disquiet and, I suppose, disillusionment among women about, you know, how their stories are being used, how they're being used, how their lives are being used. And, you know, 10, 15 years on, they, you know, they don't have the basics in terms of, you know, basic kind of counselling and treatment for trauma, or basic access to healthcare, or access to training and employment, and so on. So there are serious concerns, and then you know, the likes of Julie Mertes has written about you know, whether or not the logic of the adversarial you know, prosecution of wartime sexual violence can ever really deliver justice for women, in the sense that women need justice. And so there are questions about that, which is not to say that it hasn't been hugely important. But also we see it hasn't hugely been important to get that recognition. But there are questions about, notwithstanding all of the kind of excellent provisions that are in place in terms of gender sensitivity and, not taking into account women's past histories and so on and so forth, there are important, but there haven't actually been, you know, a whole lot of examples of the use of these provisions. And so far, and there is research ongoing, and we won't know for another while yet, but we should begin to know in the next couple of years, really what the consensus seems to be about how effective these mechanisms are on behalf of women. There's also then the tendency to, you know, think that maybe more restorative justice mechanisms may work better for women. But the research also indicates that this is not necessarily the case. You know, truth and reconciliation processes, truth commissions and so on, or like the Gacaca courts in Rwanda, which are kind of community-based, using customary court-type processes, in order, because the scale of the violations, the numbers of violations are so enormous, that it's simply not possible to process them in the very fragile and underdeveloped justice systems that are put in place post-conflict. There has been a tendency or a move towards using these restorative or these popular modes of justice. And the research indicates there that women are not faring very well. The same kinds of gender biases and patriarchal biases and gender blindness prevails in these scenarios as well, leaving women very much disempowered as well. So there's a lot of very interesting work emerging there. Also, in the last number of years, very recently, since 2008, you do have a kind of a new spate of UN Security Council resolutions that are following up on UN Security Council Resolution 1325 in 2000, which was all about, you know, the comprehensive empowerment and inclusion of women in all aspects of peace negotiation and peace building and post-conflict transformation. And that hasn't really delivered. And there are really, you know, important kind of questions to be raised and asked about that. But more recently, we've seen a shift to trying to strengthen that implementation with a very great focus on wartime sexual violence again. And in a way that's in danger of eclipsing the, I would say, probably the most radical element of 1325, which was the obligation to ensure women's full and equal participation. A recognition that unless women are at the table, are decision makers, that their vulnerability in times of war, conflict and upheaval to you know, sexual violence, you know, will not be minimized until there's a shift, a very real shift in power sharing and decision making for women.
It brings us back to your older theme, in a sense, of how you do human rights being possibly more important than what themes in particular you're going after, or what crimes you're naming, but this business about how one does human rights and who's participating in the process as being really, really the key element to empowering people within this language of human rights, like you say, rather than a top-down model. You have one – this is all so interesting. And there's one last thing that you sort of close your book on that I think is also enormously important, and I want to be able to spend just a couple of minutes on that. We talked earlier quite a lot about CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And among other things that's happened with the history of CEDAW is, of course, a kind of a run-in with questions of what you call multiple fundamentalisms and how we think about the relationship between women's human rights and cultural rights. We think, of course, a lot about Islamic fundamentalism, but as you note in your book, and many of us are also quite aware, Christian fundamentalism can be a threat to women's human rights. And because this is so much a theme in the news today, I wonder if you can speak a little bit about that and where you think we stand.
Yeah, I mean, I have done some work in recent years around this whole dilemma. I suppose moving back from a kind of a UN-oriented space, living back in Ireland over the last number of years, becoming very aware in the European context of the moral panic that has arisen around Islam in the West, and the way in which attention has homed in on Muslim women as the kind of ultimate symbol of oppression and disempowerment through the eyes of the West, it got me thinking a lot more closely about the way in which culture, in this case in particular, religious difference, is mobilized politically. And in a way, I think, I very much agree with recent work by Judith Butler and Joan Scott. And interestingly, across the political spectrum, I mean, you have Judith Butler and Joan Scott on one side, and then across the spectrum to the likes of Jean Beth Elstein in terms of conservative kind of communitarianism. What we're seeing is the one thing that people can agree on is that the most important issue is the quality of the democracy and the safeguarding against authoritarianism. There's been a conflation, I think, in this kind of within the kind of divide between the more liberal focus on universal claims, the kind of the mediating space within that, which is kind of a dialogical approach to retaining a commitment to kind of universal norms, and then the multiculturalist approach, which seems to demand a more of a kind of a relativist pluralism. And of course, where do you, as you said at the start, where do you draw the line defend women's human rights within that? It's become very clear to me as I kind of look at this closely that people are asking the wrong question in terms of it's not about religion. It's not about, the idea of the secular state or not the secular state. But it is about the regulation, the accountability of religious authority. And it is about authoritarianism. And I think Noorani Othman, I think, writes about this really very eloquently in the situation of Malaysia, that when you have religious fundamentalisms, and you're right, there's an absolute kind of preoccupation with Islam as the source of religious fundamentalism, which really has to be challenged and refuted, which is a tendency to characterize Western democratic nations as basically the kind of quintessential exemplars of what the kind of secular state is about, and then to equate Islam and the Muslim religion with the opposite of that. And I think that's very problematic because, of course, women are completely caught in the logic of that as Muslim women symbolizing the kind of the eternally oppressed and disenfranchised woman, which is very problematic. And also falsely really suggesting that Western developed states have the monopoly on the kind of the this particular well-oiled kind of secular state. Because if you look at the research in terms of sociology of religion, there's very, very few states that are secular in that sense. Religious ethos, religious values, religious actors permeate most societies in one form or another. I mean, I'm very aware of that in the situation of Ireland, where kind of conservative Catholic ethos still is hugely influential in the delivery of healthcare and the delivery of education. And yet Ireland would be perceived as a Western modern secular society, of late in the last decade. And it actually just isn't true. So I'm just interested in really problematizing that supposed dichotomy between kind of the secular West and the kind of irrational, where Islam is an important religion. There's an assumption that we're dealing with a kind of fundamentalism automatically, but where various strains of Christianity are present, that's not seen as a problem. So I think it's probably makes much more sense from a human rights perspective to look at the exercise of religious authority in whatever form it takes as any form of arbitrary authority, and look at how that is impinging on various human rights, and how it impinges on women's human rights as defined by women in their context. So I suppose it's the wrong question. Noorani Othman, talks about the Islamization of Malaysia, and she said this was not about the steady Islamization of Malaysia didn't occur because people were more and more devout and wanted a more and more Islamic state. It came about, from her analysis, because conditions of fear, intimidation, and authoritarianism took root, so that people became afraid not to allow the Islamification take place. So in other words, it was a question of the weakness of democracy and a failure of democracy rather than a rise in religious fervor. And women living under Muslim laws, the network that has been operating since the 1980s, has done lots of documentation that around this. I mean, their position always is that when you see religious fundamentalist movements or autocratic religious movements, that they are political. They are authoritarian political movements that are using religion to gain certain ends. They're not actually religious movements in the sense of devout people rising up and wanting a more devout estate that reflects this particular religious perspective. So, yeah. I was just going to, I think it's hugely problematic. The way in which there are very big problems with the way in which Islam and Muslim women are figured in these debates through the Western lens, and I think that if we ask questions about authoritarianism and empowerment and democracy rather than religious identity, I think we're more on the mark in terms of protecting women's human rights and asking what are the conditions where women can effectively claim their human rights and seek to protect their human rights, and others can work in solidarity with them as they do that. And it is really about the conditions for, interestingly enough, we come back to some of the civil and political rights in terms of freedom of association, freedom of expression. So that the clash we get, I'm more familiar with the clashes that's unfolding within Europe, but the focus on women's headscarves is bizarre from a human rights perspective, with the French government prohibiting and fining women for wearing burqas and so on. It's so obviously a violation of women's human rights to prohibit the wearing of Muslim headdress or to compel the wearing of any kind of headdress in the name of religion. They are equally violations of women's kind of self-determination and moral autonomy and freedom of expression and all sorts of things. So, you can't, but the sort of the one size fits all top-down idea that this symbolizes women's oppression, therefore we are going to save women from themselves, we're going to save, again, Gayatri Spivak's phrase, brown women from brown men, is hugely problematic and obviously completely antithetical to any kind of emancipatory notion of women's human rights.
It's a wonderful way to sort of reframe the question, right? To sort of shift the attention from religion, from fundamentalism, and particularly from particular religion to the civic sphere and to, like you say, authoritarianism rather than the democratic process. This book covers so much territory. I enjoyed reading it immensely, and I've had my students read it. They've gotten enormous amounts from it. We've covered a lot of ground in today's talk, and I want to just end by asking you a kind of a traditional question on the New Books Network, which is what you're doing now.
Well, I have a couple of projects, but I suppose the one that I'm heading into in depth at the moment is I'm interested in Security Council Resolution 1325. I'm interested in the latest developments in terms of armed conflict and women in conflict-affected situations and transitions from conflict. And so I'm very interested in, you know, how the Security Council has been engaged with, how the promulgation of Security Council resolutions, particularly around wartime sexual violence, are playing out in conflict-affected situations. So the research that I'm going to be embarking on in the next couple of months is specifically looking at peace support operations, which are a growing and expanding, a huge slice of what the UN does. And there is this obligation to comprehensively address gender equality and women's human rights in the context of peace support operations. And again, it is this interest that I have in, well, what does this look like in practice? How do these peace support operations, which really are a confluence of military and civilian and police and UN and diplomatic and local, inchoate kind of governance structures and emerging civil society structures. So these are spaces where efforts are being made to keep gender equality and women's human rights on the agenda. So I'm very interested in looking at this in detail, maybe in the case of a couple of specific countries and across a few regions, but also looking at the Security Council resolution, it's the Security Council as a site for the generation of resolutions, its relationship with the Secretary General, how the UN as a space interfaces then on the ground with these conflict affected situations, and how women figure in that, and what is the transformative potential of the the various Security Council resolutions that have been passed, since the 2001, and most specifically these last three or four, because there's also a trend to foreground the protection of civilians and to link that with the protections in terms of sexual violence. And I suppose the question I have is, how do we keep on the agenda the requirement that 1325 places to ensure the comprehensive inclusion of women's participation in decision-making and in the sharing of power, as well as the comprehensive inclusion of gender perspective in all aspects of these transitions from conflict.
What a great project. Look forward to reading that. It's so very timely, right? This is stuff that that we so badly need study of. Thanks so much for your time. This has been just fascinating work that you're involved in. It's so good to have had you on the program.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Our guest today has been Niav Riley, author of Women's Human Rights, Polity Press, 2009. I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies. Thanks very much for joining us.